Good morning. It's wonderful to be back with you here this morning, First Baptist Church. I was thinking through, it was about 6 months ago, and it kind of feels like yesterday, so it's weird how time flies. But this morning, we'll be looking at a chapter from Exodus, chapter 16, verses 4 through 8, and continuing with verses 13 through 20. They read, starting with verse 4, chapter 16. Then the Lord said to Moses, I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on the other days. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, in the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord. Continuing with verse 13. In the evening quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew on the ground. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much as it of you need, or as much of it as each of you needs, an omer per person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tent. The Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less, but when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing left over, and those who gathered little had no shortage. They gathered as much as each of them needed. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over until morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it until morning, and it became wormy and rotten. Some of you might know, some might not, but I'm currently a seminary student. I'm also under care for ordination with the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. But seminary isn't my first graduate school experience. As I approach the end of my time in college, I, as so many other college students, had not one clue what I was going to do after college. When I had started my undergrad program, I had thought I'd wanted to go to law school, which is really funny to me now, given kind of what I do for work, and just the idea of me having to wear a suit and carry a briefcase every day is just kind of far out. The reason, though, that I wanted to pursue law school was I knew absolutely positively that I wanted to study history while I was in college. I knew I didn't want to teach because I have so much respect for teachers that I wouldn't try to be one. And the alternative to going to teach history was to use a history degree to be a springboard to go into law school. It's something my uncle had done. So as I kind of came to terms with the changing plans of my life, not knowing what I want to do, at the time I was kind of left a little bit listless. On the last day, while I was on campus in my junior year of college, I had a brief conversation with my German professor, who was also a medieval literature scholar. He introduced me to a world of something called medieval studies, and encouraged me to look into the field as an option after I graduated. During that next summer, I researched schools, looked at some of the programs nationwide. In the fall of my senior year of college, I embarked on the task of applying for graduate school, writing samples, references, applications, the GRE, academic resume, and more time than I would like to remember through that process. I graduated from college the spring of 2016, and in August of that year, I moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan, to begin a master's degree in medieval history. After 2 years of reading and papers and comprehensive exams, I was able to receive my degree, and the endlessly funny to me reactions from people when I tell them that I have a master's degree in medieval history. Those reactions usually fall into one of two categories. On one side, it's, wow, that's really cool. Or on the other side, it's, cool? Like, what do you do with that? To answer the second question, not a whole lot. But I have lots of fun facts. See, one of the requirements of my program and most graduate programs is reading proficiency in languages that are in English. And for medieval history, one of those languages you have to learn is Latin. On the surface, again, this might not be super useful unless I decide to attend Mass at the Vatican. But languages, in my opinion, are one of the absolute most interesting things to study. Every single word that we use in our everyday lives holds within it tons of different past meanings and stories and context and history that we can start to kind of dig out and unpack through careful study, through reflections. We kind of get to be detectives with every single word that we use. I'll give you an example. When I was younger, I remember peppering my parents with questions, as I'm sure most children do, and one of those questions still stuck out in my head because I figured out an answer to it based on language. Why does the meat of an animal have a different name than the animal itself? Well, with the combination of medieval history and language studies, we get an interesting answer. In the year 1066, an event known as the Battle of Hastings forever changed the English language. William, the Duke of Normandy, which was an area in northern France, beat a group of English rulers, leaving French-descended individuals to rule England. From then on, the upper class of people in England spoke French, and the lower class of people in England spoke Old English, which is a language that is closer to modern-day German. Meat was extremely expensive. It was a delicacy that only the upper class of society could afford. So the names of all of the meats were influenced by the French who ruled the country. So the French word for beef is bœuf. Same with the French word for mutton, which is mouton, or venison, venison. Jambon is ham, and pork is pork. The lower class, Old English speakers, would be the ones to work with the animals. Again, Old English is closer to modern-day German than our modern English, so we see the animal names that we use close to modern-day German. The word Schwein is swine, pigs. Kuh is cow. Hähnchen is chicken, and Tier is deer. Back to my youthful question. Why does the animal have a different name than the meat that we call it? Because of an event that happened over 7,000 miles away, almost 1,000 years ago. So what is the point of this? One, now you have a fun trivia fact, and you have an answer to my question of what I do with a degree in medieval history. But two, it's to illustrate that words hide secrets and we can dig them up like archaeologists. We celebrated Thanksgiving just a few months ago. During Thanksgiving, fall decorations make an appearance, and one of the staples of those Thanksgiving decorations is the classic cornucopia. In modern depictions, the cornucopia is typically a hollow, horn-shaped wicker basket filled with different kinds of festive fruit and vegetables. In most of North America, the cornucopia has come to be associated with Thanksgiving, with harvest, the fall time activities. Cornucopias are also known as the horn of plenty, which ties directly to two Latin words, making up the word that we're familiar with. Cornu is the word for horn. Horn of plenty. But this morning, I want to look at the word copia, cornucopia, horn of plenty. Instead of plenty, I would want to suggest that it would probably be better translated as abundance, not plenty. So with these constant reminders every fall going into our holiday season and our new year of this horn of abundance. I want to further talk about how stepping into this idea of abundance, resting in abundance, working to cultivate an abundance mindset versus a scarcity, a not enough mindset, ties directly how we cultivate gratitude in this new year. Beyond that, I think it's important to connect that abundance mindsets tied with gratitude allows us to love our neighbors better. This tension between abundance and scarcity shines through this familiar Exodus story that we looked at today. In the Exodus passage, we see this example of abundance in contrast with scarcity. This bread of heaven is in abundance for the Israelites as they walk through the wilderness. So much so that we also see the Israelites trying to take and store some of this manna, believing there will not be enough the next day. They still remember their captivity in Egypt, where storing just the tiniest piece of bread meant a small certainty for food tomorrow. But those who store up more manna than they needed for the day found the substance in the morning wormy and rotten. This instance demonstrates the Israelites struggling in their wilderness experience, struggling within their identity and security, and struggling with this conception of abundance and scarcity. In the wilderness, the Israelites have gotten out of the Egyptian system, a system of scarcity. But through their wilderness experience, we see the Israelites trying to get the Egyptian system out of themselves. Scarcity really begins this wilderness experience even before kind of the Israelites come on the scene. See, Egypt is an economic powerhouse, holds a monopoly over the food. It's the breadbasket of the ancient world. But setting up this Exodus passage today in its context, all of this influence that Egypt holds starts with a nightmare. In Genesis, Joseph decodes the dream of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh's nightmare is about scarcity, about not enough. The one who has everything he could ever want dreams about not having enough. So through the rest of the narratives, it sets off this program of pulling together all of the methods and modes of food manufacturing until the one at the top of the pyramid, Pharaoh, controls both food and, by extension, the people, leading to the slavery of the Israelites preceding today's passage. See, the system built on the fear of scarcity, the fear of not having enough, leads to those living with anxiety and fear, most especially, again, this fear of scarcity. And those living in that system do not have the time or the energy for the good of others. Early in Exodus, we see the Pharaoh's taskmaster mentality, a fear-induced scarcity mindset, not enough, leading to an increasingly worse treatment of the Israelites. The ruthlessness of Pharaoh eventually reaches a breaking point, and the human suffering cannot remain silent. It is a cry that the social system of Pharaoh's empire has failed, and the cry of the abused laborers reaches God, for God draws the cries of the abused to God's self. God's care for the abused peoples, broken down by this system of scarcity that doesn't work, brings about human action, and Moses responds, leading the Israelite people out of this scarcity system, dreaming of something better, dreaming of abundance. Longing for a return while in the wilderness, the Israelites meet the difficulty of trusting in abundance, desiring to return even to captivity where they had food. There is a comfort in the certainty, even if it's under the scarcity of this empire. in a space or a setting that we would expect continued scarcity, which is the wilderness, we're surprised by what we find, by what we see. The Israelites are surprised by what they find in the morning, asking, "What is it?" giving us the word from manna. God again responds to their cries of need in both the evening and the morning through divine abundance in this environment of scarcity. We see the claim this narrative is working to make. Wilderness is a place that cannot sustain life. God redefines that place through abundant generosity. This narrative embodies God's capacity for generosity that is in contrast to the nightmare of scarcity fueled by Pharaoh. The Israelites are overwhelmed by this divine abundance, but the reaction demonstrates that they're still stuck in Pharaoh's system of scarcity. In spite of Moses' mandate to take only what they need, the Israelites take extra. They fill their pockets, they fill their baskets, and we note again that it becomes rotten and wormy. He says, "Take only enough for today, so that everyone has enough for himself." No saving, no squandering away, no holding on. This bread of heaven is a counter to the rat race of production shown by the Egyptian system. The Creator God who provides the bread breaks the grip of Pharaoh's food control. Overabundance overshadows scarcity. Food is freely given and received. Everyone has enough. Not more, not less. As it says in verse 18, they gathered as much as each of them needed. The gift of abundance had freed them from scarcity, sure, but it had also opened the door for them to pursue the work of community, the common good, the good of their neighbors. People in a scarcity system cannot work to build community, cannot work to cultivate being a neighbor. We see in the command of verse 5, it reads, "On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days." In this reference to Sabbath, God is supporting this day of rest, a day for community enhancement, for eating together, for sharing memories. All of these things have no production value. This narrative invites us into an alternative way of being, one that is ordered according to divine generosity and abundance. Israel discovers this alternative in the wilderness. This reality becomes something Israel returns to in its long history, the tension between Pharaoh's system of scarcity and God's offer of abundance. The Israelites got out of the Egyptian system, but there is also need for the Israelites to get the Egyptian system out of themselves. Again, people living in a system of anxiety and fear, leading to scarcity, leading to greed, have no time or energy for community. An immense act of generosity founded on abundance is required to break the death grip that the Egyptian system has on the Israelites. People surrounded by abundant generosity are able to get their minds off themselves and can be about the work of neighborhood. A not too different reality faces us today. We're pulled between scarcity that directs us towards control and the hoarding of what we have on one end, and on the other end, abundance that calls forth patterns of generosity out of the state of enough, enforcing a commitment to gratitude and, by extension, the building of community. Enough for me, enough for my neighbor, and enough of systems that make manna abundant realities not possible. Enough for me. I'll say at the outset, enough of enough for me is kind of subjective. It's a little bit floofy. See, because we don't have the privilege of our manna becoming wormy and rotten if we take too much. Any Israelite who took too much knew within 24 hours if they had messed up. We don't have that luxury. See, for us, enough for me requires a high degree of self-awareness, of self-reflection, of honesty with myself. It also requires a willingness to sacrifice when we admit we have taken more than enough. Remember, our manna doesn't rot tomorrow. As with any skill, though, we get better when we practice it. And I will say here, just to head off a possible conclusion, I don't think this is a call to living like a pauper or having nothing in this world. Because refer back to our text, verse 16, gather as much of it as each of you needs, an omer per person according to the number of persons. So an omer per person per day. What does that even mean? In dry weight, an omer equals 3.5 to 4 pounds. 4 pounds of manna every morning for each person, supplemented by the quail they took in the evening. When I was a young kid, I was kind of fluffy. I was often told that I ate a lot. Setting aside that this probably isn't the best thing to tell a kid, I don't think even me at that time could have sat down and ate 4 pounds of anything. But that's how much each of the Israelites got every morning. Our immediate experience of the kingdom of scarcity in our present day, remembering Egypt, is this entitled need to want more, in which those at the top or those striving to be at the top imagine that something more will make us more comfortable, safer, happier, whatever it is. I always found it really, really ironic that the day after we celebrate the giving of thanks is Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday. The days after Thanksgiving are marked by a mad rush to buy and spend and get more. This is the rush for bigger, newer, better, on and on, year after year after year. And the best antidote to this rat race, as the Israelites discovered, was recognizing abundance instead of scarcity, stepping into gratitude and acting upon gratitude. Again, taking only what they needed, abundance for each individual. Enough for my neighbor. At the start, I admit, enough for my neighbor is kind of idealistic. The reality of the Egyptian system of fear and anxiety, scarcity present among us today, means that some have more than enough. They have taken many more omers than they need, and consequently, some don't have enough. Looking back at our verses, verse 16 and following, an omer per person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tents. The Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing left over, and those who gathered little had no shortage. They gathered as much as each of them needed. This narrative journey from scarcity to abundance to neighborhood is a key journey that all of us need to take in order to be human. That narrative journey must be made again and again every day that we live, because the kingdom of scarcity has an immense influence, drawing us out of abundance. So again and again, we have to wander into our own wildernesses, or unfortunately submit to this kingdom of scarcity. Join the rat race and imagine that this is just the way things are always going to be. When we are secure in a manna abundant reality, when we recognize the enoughness we have, we can begin finding places to help, places to give, places to carry an omer to our neighbor. Not just out of the small leftovers of time, material, money, or ability that we can kind of scrounge up after everything else in our lives, but out of a deep place of a willingness to sacrifice, not out of guilt or obligation, but out of gratitude. Finally, enough of systems that make this manna abundant reality seem impossible. To begin, I'll admit that the idea of enough of these systems feels far away and impossible to achieve. This is true, at least in a small way. It does feel far away. It feels possible, impossible to achieve. But these are a space that requires us to depart, to leave. The term that the Bible says is Exodus. Depart from the broken scarcity system. We must depart from more than enough for me. We must depart from less than enough for our neighbors. And as I said again and again every day of our lives, we must wander into our own wildernesses, because the kingdom of scarcity always pulls us back. These journeys are small, they're simplistic, as the gathering of manna every morning. The Eucharist or communion that many of us in Christian communities celebrate is one of those small journeys into the wilderness, a journey marked by abundance. It is a demonstration of the way in which the gospel of abundance overrides the claim of scarcity. Communion invites us into community marked by a willingness to be a neighbor and a willingness to show gratitude. At the table, we see a gesture of divine abundance that breaks the scarcity systems. In Mark 6, verses 30 through 44, Jesus comes upon a crowd in a deserted place. He has compassion for them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. The reference to deserted place and the lack of a shepherd is intentionally reminding us of this manna narrative in Exodus. Then we are told, Jesus took 5 loaves and 2 fish, Jesus blessed them, Jesus broke them, Jesus gave them to the people. Took, blessed, broke, gave. These are the actions of abundance. It is natural to trust the narrative of scarcity. But the narrative of abundance remains among us every day, at the table where we share communion, and in small ways if we look for them every day. As we sign on to this manna abundant narrative and we leave behind the old system, a new system of dreams and hopes can be built tomorrow. The dream dissolves Pharaoh's nightmares. The one who admits enough for themselves and fights for enough for their neighbors may be among those who push beyond themselves to build a system of enough for everyone. This we can do, trusting in abundance, illuminated with gratitude for the opportunity to build community with one another. Let's pray. Oh, abundant God, give us the eyes to see where we have taken more than we need. Give us the heart of compassion to fight when others don't have enough. Give us the strength and courage and boldness to pursue a world of your manna abundant reality. Let us be an example of all who are marred by the fear and anxiety of scarcity. Let us embrace abundance, show our gratitude, and fight for enough for everyone. Amen.